Pon en marcha lo que aprendas hoy con Printful. Crea tu propia marca de ropa y accesorios. Vende productos personalizados sin tarifas de suscripción y sin stock. Nosotros nos encargamos de imprimir y enviar con tu marca. Visita printful.com/redcast y descubre todo lo que puedes vender con un 20% de descuento por venir desde Redcast.
Redcast, los mejores podcasts del mundo digital.
Bienvenido a Growth, el podcast de Product Hackers. Yo soy Corti y hoy tengo el placer de entrevistar a Adelina Peltea, una de las mayores expertas en Growth en Europa y VP, Vice President de Growth de Holded, una de las startups españolas que más crecen, que lo están petando. Con Adelina nos centramos en cómo crear una cultura de Growth y de experimentación, en estructurar adecuadamente los equipos de Growth, aprendizajes en su carrera y el crecimiento de Holded. La verdad que ha sido una maravilla aprender de ella. La entrevista, lo único, está en inglés, que lo sepas. De hecho, es nuestra primera entrevista en inglés con más de 200 episodios publicados, pero bueno, merecía muchísimo la pena hacer este esfuerzo para poder aprender de Adelina, que es una auténtica delicia. Antes de meternos en faena, recordarte que nuestro patrocinador de la semana es ABAC, el mejor servicio de gestoría en tu móvil. Con la app de ABAC podrás registrar tus tickets y facturas que irán automáticamente a tu gestor y luego se usarán para elaborar tus impuestos y este tipo de cosas. Con ABAC te puedes centrar en lo que realmente a ti te importa y dejar toda la parte administrativa para ellos. Descubre ABAC en su página web abac.app y disfruta de 30 días gratis gracias al cupón de descuento que nos han dejado para los seguidores del podcast, y el cupón es en digital, todo juntito, en digital. Y sin más, pasamos a la entrevista con Adelina Peltea. Hi everyone and welcome. I'm Corti from Product Hackers, and this is the first ever English live podcast we do after more than 200 episodes. This is the first one in English. So sorry for my questions. Probably they are going to be hard to understand, but the occasion was really great. We really wanted to interview our guest today. And that's why we are doing this in English. Today we have Adelina Peltea, Vice President of Growth at Holded. She's one of the most well-known growth professionals in Europe, and Holded is one of the fastest growing startups in Spain. So it's a real pleasure to have you here, Adelina. Thank you very much for coming here, Adelina.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for accommodating to run it in English. I hope it's going to be interesting for everyone.
I'm pretty sure. For us, it's also growth, because it's the best option to learn more English is to practice it. So for me, it's a great occasion to grow in my personal side. Just in case I fail with my questions, because they are like too really experts in growth. I have with me Juan Mabaro and Pavel Mazuelas, two of our best growth managers at Product Hackers. And they also wanted to ask a lot of questions to Adelina. Juanma, Pavel, welcome.
Hello. Thank you for hearing us and watching us. And it's a big pleasure to have you here, Adelina. Instead of speaking in English, you needed another language, we can learn it just to have you here.
Thank you, Corti, to having me here. And thank you, Adelina. I think we for sure we are going to learn a lot about you and all your big experience in growth. And I would like to hear your story.
And we are going to start with Adelina's story. Adelina, what's like a brief history of you from the beginning of your professional life until today at Holded?
Oh, I can go way back. I guess when I was growing up, my family was having quite a few businesses. So that exposed me to the entrepreneurship world and to the uncertainty and challenges and all that. So I kind of grew up on that. And also surrounded by a lot of technology. My father was literally a geek, so I had all the latest technology at home. I could always play with it. So fast track a few decades later, I'm working in technology startups and helping them grow. My main formation was in marketing. I studied marketing, and this is what I've been doing for quite a few years. I had my own businesses back when I was in Europe. Then I started joining the leadership teams of a few SaaS businesses because I predominantly focused on the subscription model. I was in Singapore for 5 years in the leadership team of a few SaaS businesses in different fields. Then I moved to Spain. I'm in Barcelona now for the last 3 years, where I was managing the marketing team at Typeform, which is one of the most popular SaaS product-led growth companies here. And then 1 year and a half ago, I joined Holded, which is also in SaaS and product-led growth, as a VP of growth. And it's been quite an interesting and fast journey. Even if Corona hit us and everything, we kept growing. So it was very good times.
You are like, you can't be stopped. If just in case someone is listening and don't know about Holded, I think it's weird because I see Holded everywhere, but just in case, what does Holded and what are your actual numbers, number of people, revenue if you can share or whatever you think is interesting for the audience to understand the actual state of the business?
So, yes, we are fast growing. Can't really share much here the numbers, but I would say when I joined, we just raised Series A. And at that point, the Series A lead investor actually spotted us because we are growing super fast. And they spotted us on one of the tools that track the velocity of traffic on websites, on businesses. And then about a year and a half later, so at the end of last year, we raised Series B. So we overcame all the uncertainty of last year and we did quite well. We are about, I think, 80 people now and hiring quite a lot. So check out our jobs portal if you're interested in all sorts of teams. We have a product that has a lot of potential. So we have very clear what are the areas that we can expand into. So in terms of product expansion and market expansion, and also as channels, we mainly developed one channel until now, which is a good approach. So we're still solidifying that. And this year we start building another channel. So there's a lot of opportunities on the table, growing super fast. The biggest challenge now it's in executing well, prioritizing well, and making sure we don't kind of miss the focus and the pathway.
It sounds simple and it's so complicated to execute well and prioritize and do what is the most important thing you have to do. I also wanted to know a little bit about your evolution from marketing. You said you were at Typeform managing the marketing, and now you are in charge of growth. What changes between marketing and growth? Most of the time, I think people mislead marketing and growth. What do you think they are different? And also, in which parts of marketing and growth can be seen something similar?
That's a very good question. And I'm sure lots of people are considering this change in their career nowadays. Like growth roles have become very appealing for lots of reasons. And I know lots of marketers or data people or all sorts of different profiles moving into this. In the end, that's exactly what you need in growth. It's a bit of perspective. So it's good to come from a vertical where you have proven that you have a certain mindset, generally tending more towards data-driven rather than just conceptual and being very results-oriented. But ultimately, you need to have quite a bit of horizontal knowledge of the business. So what helped me to do this transition was the fact that I specialized in a specific type of business model. So as I said, I specialized in SaaS for almost a decade now, and in product-led growth, the last two companies, so Holded and Typhoon, which are actually quite product-led growth is still a new concept. And I would say having 3 years of experience in this field in two of the fastest growth companies, that's quite interesting. So that helped me really get involved into all sorts of areas of the business and understand how it truly works. And that enables my transition from marketing to growth. I was always a curious person, so it's good to have like anchoring yourself into a business model or an industry or something, and then you can expand horizontally. The data-driven mindset, I mentioned it before, that's also like something you can take from marketing to growth. Marketers nowadays are more and more data-driven, so that it's happening anyway. But then the whole approach, it's quite different because now you don't necessarily think just of channels and campaigns and messaging and things like that, but you think of the way I look, growth is more like it's an equation of the business and you have different levers and you need to understand what's the potential if you pull different levers at different times and how much confidence you have on potentially achieving those. And in most cases, it requires cross-functional resources. So to zoom in a bit on this, on the growth levers, I always like to look at the overall of a business. And what happens usually when you start from marketing, you just want to do more marketing. But when you come from a growth lens perspective, you just look at the overall and you might say, well, maybe it's not worth investing here, but worth investing here and so on. Or different time challenges, like for example, last year when we were faced with the economic downturn and uncertainty and we had to delay a little bit our fundraising, we chose to work on our monetization, so potentially increasing ARPA, which would help us with our unit economics and growing faster with the resources we have. And we did manage, we actually doubled the ARPA post the pricing change. So that was a very good one. And yeah, so you could use all this equation to pull things in different ways. And then, as I said, you need the cross-functional resources in most cases to make it happen. Now, most people dream that you are given this growth team that has everything in it. It happens in some cases, and companies are starting to be adopting it more and more. But to be more realistic, you can also start just by saying, look, as a company, at this point, we have a few cross-functional pillars or projects, initiatives, things like this. And you just start going with this approach and you get, maybe you have, like I give the example at Holded where only now we started building a data team. So last year we only had one data analyst. And of course, it's not like we can have a data analyst in the growth team and a data analyst in product and so on. So we just had to be very wise in terms of how do we choose the priorities at company level and then have this person join us for those. So each time period had a specific focus area and a milestone we wanted to reach and a North Star metric and some leading indicators for that. And we would rotate the resources based on this. And then, of course, as the company grows, you can afford to have dedicated people to each area, which, of course, is better because then nothing gets missed, but it also adds more complexity.
And I have a question. Now that you are speaking between the difference between marketing and growth, imagine that I'm a person who works in marketing for 10 years and I would like to jump into growth department. Which thing do you suggest to me? Like go to study a course about growth or I don't know, which kind of suggestion can you make us?
I like to combine theory and practice at the same time. So kind of learn by doing, but solidify it with some concepts and frameworks on top. I would recommend to just create with some colleagues from other teams a cross-functional project and try to learn by doing how that works in terms of dynamics, in terms of understanding different areas, understanding different profiles, having a very different mindset about how you run things and why you run things and try to get the results on this and kind of like have a snowball effect on this rather than just thinking that you can just jump from I'm now employed as a marketer and then I just need to get another job to do this. So start from practicing this. I've been doing this for quite a while before officially changing my role into growth. And also, I would recommend a few courses. I'm really a big fan of Reforge. They have these courses online, so it's quite easy to join from anywhere in the world. I attended their Growth Fundamentals course in 2017, and that really helped put things into perspective, because everything I kind of noticed until then was more on a case-by-case basis, was more like, oh, growth is more like growth hacking, it's A-B testing, it's, yeah, hacking pretty much. But this course gave me a whole other perspective over like what I call this growth equation, and how you look at everything and how you understand how the different parts move and what's the smartest move you can make at any given time. So that helped a lot. And then last year I did also from them the monetization course. Monetization, it's one of these areas where you don't really have specialists in a business. There's no one dedicated to it, no one owning it. There is just this thought from time to time, once a year or something, people think, oh, let's do a pricing change, but there's not much expertise on this. And I thought it's very interesting because it's one of these cross-functional areas. On a fun note, when I learned marketing in university, they were telling us, you know, the four P's of marketing: product, pricing, all that, it's in marketing. So kind of like, okay, closing the loop. But yeah, this course was also like quite interesting. And I would say as an easy entry into growth, you could look into monetization because it's kind of a green field. You don't have much competition as a talent nowadays. And following that, last year, I applied what I learned there and everything I knew from working in all these SaaS businesses, where we also did lots of pricing changes. And a lot of reading that I did on user psychology. So it's not just data per se, but psychology that you also need to pay attention to. and we did a survey to kind of build proposals based on data. And we managed to do a pricing change that, as I said, got us a double ARPA post the pricing change with the same customer base. So not going up market. While most companies increase by going up market. So that wasn't our case.
That's really nice. We will ask you a little bit more about that in next question. But Angel was asking us in the chat if the growth mindset or mentality is this key for becoming a successful growth manager. And I will also say, ask you if this mindset is important to be in the company. If a company does not have this growth mindset, do you think the company can perform growth?
I would flip this and I would say that if you work in a startup, regardless of your role, you better have a growth mindset, because as a startup, you need to grow very fast, to be very resourceful, to understand different perspectives. So you need it across the board. For a growth role specifically, I would say just you can start applying experience you have in different areas, connecting different areas, and being less about what you're experienced to do as, like, you know, if you come from marketing, you do more campaigns or whatever, but actually be more curious about what are the smartest things you can do at a given time. So, for example, should you do campaigns just because you used to do campaigns, or shall we look into monetization because there's a lot of potential at the moment, and so on?
Okay, you're great. I think regarding this, as you said, in every startup, you need to have like a growth mentality. But the reality is that most startups have like this. They want to grow. They want to be fast and so on. But maybe they are not focused on experiments. They are not focused on testing things. And most, I've seen a lot of startups like follow whatever the CEO says or whatever. How can you integrate this more growth or experimental culture in a company that is actually not following that and more following the lead of the CEOs and a more objective way of doing things?
Experiments, I think, are also a bit misunderstood. So lots of people would strictly think of A-B testing. Now, truth be told, if you are a startup, until a certain size, you can't really afford to do A/B testing because for the volumes you have in the beginning, it will take you a long period of time to get to conclusive results. Hence, you know, if you want to test this button here with this message or this button here and you are a small startup, forget about it. It's going to take you 6 months to get to results, so you can do 2 experiments per year. Of course, this gets more interesting as you grow, and it's not something I would discard, but just setting expectations that A/B testing is not all that there is. So for example, I recommend a lot getting as much data as possible before doubling down on projects and not just going blindly doing something because you did. That can involve testing stuff. Like, for example, we test a lot of things through advertising because it's something we can control and push as much as we want. We did this for testing acquisition through different product verticals or different markets. I recommend doing research. Like, we've done a few surveys. One was for monetization last year. This year we do another thing on understanding something related to brand and positioning. So kind of like always look for some data, but more to know either what to choose to do or where to double down, so to say. But it's not necessarily always about this A/B test. So experiments can take all shape and forms. And in startups, you can be quite bold and try things. I think the key is just to make sure you always learn from this. So for example, you can go and do something and it's not necessarily an A/B test. But how would you define the success of the project? So kind of before you even do it, think what success should look like and how you could learn from it. To be honest, we had some projects where we didn't set this up correctly. We didn't even manage to track the results correctly because they were mixed with all sorts of other changes. So that's a failure. That's a real failure in terms of kind of doing something and not learning from it and not knowing what to do next. Like, did it work? Didn't work? What worked? What didn't work? Stuff like that. So that to me is the real experimentation mindset. So everyone in the company can have a lot of opinions and proposals and ideas, and they are all welcome. But the main challenge for a startup, because of the limited resources, and I would say especially the limited time, because you need to grow very fast, it's knowing what to choose to do. And instead of going into debates, it's better just to try things, but try them in a way in which you define how you would learn and make sure you would learn with real numbers.
How do you choose when you have like a lot of possibilities, a lot of ideas from the team and opportunities? Which is the steps you follow to know where to invest more time?
I think I've tried everything under the sky. So you know, the ICE proposals, impact, confidence, effort. I am a fan of memos as well, so I like when people prepare like a well-documented one-pager over what they want to do and why and how they would measure it. But sometimes it's just, you don't need that level of complexity because sometimes you just define a bit more strategically, okay, these are the pillars where it makes sense for us to dive into this year based on different arguments. And then the projects that just make sense for that, you can just go ahead and do it and then think more on other perspectives, like, do we have the right talents for this? Do we have the right bandwidth? Things like that. So in some cases, I'm very particular about understanding why we should do certain projects. And in some cases, I'm like, of course, it makes it's part of a specific theme in which we grow. So let's just go for it if you think this is the best and so on.
Okay, and how you decide the priorities for the year? No, you are like aligning. Okay, this year we are going to prioritize on things, and everything that is down those pillars, we are going to double down. But from a strategical point of view, it's really hard to know where you have to invest the time. Do you follow something? Is something related to your North Star and you are the composing it, or which are the steps?
I actually created a framework around this. I call it the focus timeline. And I recommend every company to do it about once a year, because I feel like everything we use otherwise, like project management or OKRs, it's kind of good at efficiency, so doing well what you have to do, but not at knowing what you have to do. So I think this is kind of like the overarching thing that would connect all the dots. And to do a focused timeline, I usually look at data that we have, different metrics in the company, the classic metrics, and I just benchmark it with other companies so we know, okay, what are the biggest gaps and where we think we can make a difference and how. I listen to the teams a lot. Like there are lots of people that are more close to like either the customer or any different aspect of the business. So there are lots of people that would have very interesting proposal, and it's just like, give yourself time once a year or so to be again curious, listen to everything, get out of execution mode and more in just questions and understanding mode, and put it all together. And then it's actually quite easy to define what to do. What is harder is to what to say no to. So kind of like, where do you stop? And for example, in Holded's case, as I said, we mainly grew from one channel, and we are still putting 80% of our efforts in that channel because there is still more space to consolidate it. At the same time, we were reactive on another channel. We only had a person for a couple of years. We saw some traction there. Now we are capable to put more resources and more focus into it at the company level. So we started growing this channel as well. But again, it's coming as a... So I guess it's this. It's more not what to do, what to say no to and why, and understanding that you can usually put kind of 20% of the volume of stuff, although it's most of the effort, into 80% of the results. And if I am to make a list of all the projects we run at the moment, the 80% of the projects, so it looks like a lot, it's actually more on the 20% effects nowadays, but there are things we are exploring or preparing for the future. Many times I run things that I'm declaring, okay, it's not part of our focus in this period of time, but it's going to be next year or whatever. So we need to do some projects to kind of like get some validation to get in there. But that's why what I was saying previously, be very clear on why you start a project. What do you want to learn? How do you define success? How can you make sure you learn?
Okay, and when you decide where are you going to put this focus and the teams has to work to get that, how they are organized? I mean, they have like, for example, every experiment or every strategy that you are going to run needs some kind of team, or all the team has like a backlog of different things and when finish one, enter to the another one?
Yeah, glad you asked. So, after a focused timeline, I tend to do a reorg as well. So it also comes about once a year. And then depending on the phases we set, the resources that are more limited, we kind of rotate them through, but they know what to expect. So it's kind of not so ad hoc. It's a bit more planned, but also it's planning in terms of what we'll be focusing on and what kind of people we might need. But it's not planned in terms of the exact solutions we are trying to build. So when we get to solutions, it's kind of bottom up, actually, and only done when we reach that phase. So we don't over plan it in advance. So at Holder, for example, I changed the org structure twice in the growth team. And that was mainly depending on what we had to achieve and how our plans change. Most companies structure their teams based on either the classic departments or just something they've seen in other companies. I would really not recommend that, because another company you might look into have different challenges, want to solve different things. So just look at yourself and what's the best way to put people together. I like to make teams as autonomous as possible, so they don't need to borrow resources from one another, or at least when they need to solve something for a given period of time, they have as much as possible in their team. That avoids a lot of friction and politics and slowing down. Of course, it's not always perfect, because again, like, you can't have a fully cross-functional team all the time with everything you need, but as much as possible, we try to get to that, like an 80%, I would say. And from what I learned, people also like to rotate a little bit, learn a bit more, or again, maybe that's it's mostly in startup environment, but it's usually quite positive for people and they feel like they're growing. It also comes with challenges because, you know, I would see many times in some meetings where people would use words that are very specific in that field, but makes no sense for another team. So I would find myself being like the translator of the concepts. So you have to be very mindful when you work like this and understand that not everyone has the same background and the same expertise.
And which is your actual structure of growth? You said that you changed it. How is actually Holded organized in terms of growth?
So when I joined Holded, I got under me the three teams, marketing, customer success, and sales. So everything that was kind of customer facing. I let them be for about 3 months while I tested different approaches on acquisition, and we ran some cross-functional projects where I defined different owners just to see how people would interact and what are the capabilities of everyone. And then 3 months later, we did a rework where we kind of split the teams by user journey. So kind of like a first stage of the user journey, one team with cross-functional resources and a second one. And then, as I said, in that year, we had about three different focuses, so different periods of times, and we rotated some resources based on this. And then when we raised Series B, we did another rework because now we're planning to, okay, we consolidate more on the channel that we have. We are starting a bit more to scale the other channel that we have and so on. So I completely shifted the teams. Now I have two teams that are called... No, actually, to backtrack. So last year, it was demand generation, one team which had marketing, sales, design, content, data, and so on, and customer lifecycle team, which was post-subscription, where I had CS people, and depending on what we needed, sometimes we would have some engineers and product owners for short periods of times. And then this year, I have two teams that I'm calling them product-led growth, which is about all this channel that we built, about how do we get directly to the end user, how do we grow in companies bottom up, how do we expose them as quickly as possible to the product and so on. So that's, again, marketing, creative, data, again, engineering when we need it and so on. And then I have the partnerships team. So in our case, we go for resellers, which are, in our case, accounting firms. So the product is still for the end user, which is an SMB. But because we go through this accounting firms that each can have hundreds of clients, it's kind of enterprise sales. Excuse me. And in this team, I have sales, customer success, and hiring for marketing as well. And then I have other two teams that are more support to these ones. One being growth operations, where they actually help the other two. But it's this super high profiles of people where I need them to understand the full spectrum and help on connecting dots. And then we are starting a brand and communications team, which is more classic marketing, but we plan to go more top of the funnel with a quite bold approach as well. Like we do some video documentaries that we tested last year, with advertising as well, so it's working well. So kind of so Growth Ops is more helping everyone, and brand and communications is starting to take shape, but is going to be more for a focus in the future when we'll focus much more on the top of the funnel.
It's really interesting the way you've been changing the structure of the team, and it also shows how you are changing the focus on the growth of the company. You are going for partners also in like a web-based way. So you are doing like inbound from the product and so on, because the traditional approach is like more sales. How do you approach those partners?
So it used to be only inbound over there. So it's the same. We acquire people because they hear about the product and they experience the product, and then they raise their hand to get a special deal as a partner. So this is what we've been doing for a few years now, very reactively, very few resources into it. So we're kind of like, you know, letting it there and testing the grounds. And now we take more of a mixed approach where, yes, we go a bit closer to the enterprise sales model, but we still start with the people that already got what Holded is and they came to us. And in the future, we'll start going for sales, for like outbound and things like that. It's just that even if we take inbound versus outbound approach, it's still a different experience between the product-led growth team and the partnerships team, because it's just the buying cycle is longer. There's more talking and presentations and things like that. While in product-led growth, we just try to get people into the product as quickly as possible.
You also say that you focus on one channel and you are testing other ones. Which is your main channel? Which is the main pillar of the growth of Holded in terms of new customers?
That would be advertising. So we get the people that are searching for solutions to embrace us. It comes hand in hand with the product virality loop and word of mouth. So actually, for every one customer that we acquire through advertising, we also get one customer from virality. So it's kind of 50-50. And that's something we will down the road explore much more, because Holded has a lot of potential for virality in many ways. Like, for example, even though Holded, it's an ERP for SMBs, so you use it to manage your own business. So it's kind of an internal tool, but you have lots of interactions with other businesses because you exchange all sorts of documents like invoices, sales proposals, emails, things like that, payments and so on. So through that bridge, we can capture more customers as well. And that's something like from a grown mindset perspective, what we were discussing before. Look, in our case, it's something that we have already baked into product. There's so much potential. There is a lot we can do in terms of accelerating the product virality, because sometimes just some messages and logos and buttons that you put around can really increase the virality. We've done that at Typeform. But still, we are not there yet. So that's why I'm saying we are consolidating this channel. We are starting something else. And eventually, when we get more data and engineering resources and more growth specialists, then we can really tackle these product virality growth loops. So I know most people just hear a lot of advice from podcasts and articles, and they just get excited to try all the things and like, yeah, we should do this and we should do that. But then you're spreading yourself too thin. So just bringing this dose of realism now that, yeah, we have this, but you need to kind of park them for the right moment.
I also saw that you guys are using, you have a lot of integration with a lot of platform. And my question is like, is a growth strategy to find partners like, I don't know, you have Zapier and other like kind of tools? Or also I think it's like a way to make the life of the new customers.
So integrations are a potential growth lever for sure. There is a lot of effort to put into it once you want to do it properly. It doesn't work just with some people. Like, you need to actually develop integrations. You need a team to handle the partnerships and so on. So it's not something you should just tap into lightly. Also, from what I noticed from my experience, integrations used to be a good thing for acquisition years ago. Now it's not so much. It became kind of table stakes. Like, people just need you to integrate with their stuff. It's kind of mandatory, but it's not necessarily a differentiator or anything. And definitely not an acquisition channel as it used to be. You also depend a lot on reviews in different marketplaces for this. So that's why I'm saying when you go into it, you have to go very seriously into it and have a lot of integrations with very good reviews and everything. In our case, we have a few integrations just because, again, it's table stakes. Like, we need some e-commerce integrations. We need some payment integrations. It's just mandatory. This being said, I actually just hired someone for exploring the partnership strategy. So what I said before is not our focus this year, but it's something we could consider down the road. So I'm already planting the seeds. Where we have a person that it's working on figuring out the strategy on this and getting some validation this year on some projects.
Sounds good. And I have another question, and it's about the product itself, because I can see that Holded has like a lot of different solutions, and I can imagine that you were growing this kind of solution. It's not this the same product than the product 4 years ago. So how is more or less the way you build a new feature? Because for example, we know that you can even kill your own product if you continue to create features that nobody asked for. So how is that process to understand how you can make more value of your product to reach your customers?
So we always strive for simplicity and what we call a continuous onboarding. ERPs used to be these scary things, right? They were complex, they were ugly, they were, and you cannot win SMBs through this. So for us, the user experience, it's always hyper important. And we're not saying we are perfect, but we kind of obsess on improving on it every day. This being said, an ERP obviously touches on lots of verticals like invoicing, accounting, CRM, project management, and so on. The thing is that we never plan to to win on a separate product vertical. So, for example, we wouldn't just go and try to be the best project management tool in the world, because that's not the point. We try to see how can project management connect to the other parts of the business so we streamline and automate processes, which is what our customers care about. So how do you connect project management to costs and expenses and profits? How do you connect it to invoicing? And all these things is like what interests us much more. And people might come to us because they look just for one of these individual solutions, but they stay because then they understand they can run the whole thing. And it's so much more powerful because it's all integrated and it's made specifically for small businesses. So not for complex things, not for special things, not for anything. It's just like the best practices out there. Hope that answers the question.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's very intelligent to do it like that, because the first thing I thought was why they are not using like different verticals to reach more markets. But I think that the way you are doing, well, it's clear that you are growing. So it's a very good way.
Adelina, you said before, and I think this is like when I heard it, it's like crazy that you double the ARPA of your users, the money they give you each year per each customer, changing your monetization strategy. I would love to know more about it, because as you say before, when you study marketing, you are told about pricing, but when we are talking about growth, pricing, monetization, and so on are like most of the times we don't talk about them. What's your learning there?
I would say what helped us the most was just using a lot of user psychology. So the first step was to run a survey on SMBs, so both on users and non-users. And we tried to identify what are the value metrics, what do they care about. We had this type of questions where we would make packages of features or different elements, like even support and so on, where we would ask people to rank the most preferred and the least preferred, because if you just ask what do you like, they will just give you everything. So that helped us get some understanding, but I don't think that was enough. What we did basically was, in SaaS, you are pretty, it's a kind of golden standard to have like 4 pricing plans. What happened in our case is we took the free plan with the first paid plan and put it for freelancers. So it's kind of a tab. And then we created another tab for small businesses where we continued with what used to be pricing number 3 and pricing number 4. But now we could add 2 more. So we kind of changed the distribution curve just by doing that. And then it's also a lot of psychology on how we position ourselves. So in this survey we ran initially, we looked at willingness to pay. Now, the thing is, nothing is expensive or cheap, depends on which category you put it. Like, how much would you pay for a pen versus for a phone, right? What is cheap and what is expensive? And that was the point when we understood with clear numbers that although we acquire a lot of people because they come for individual solutions, like I want an invoicing tool and so on, they, of course, just compare you to that and the price range, it's a bit more narrow. But because we had this capability of like, well, actually, you can manage your whole small business with us, that kind of put them in another box. And we are not so comparable with other cheap solutions out there. And we are not much more expensive, but it's kind of like you just change the frame. So we realized by building pricing pages that kind of reposition ourselves. So the previous pricing was more built around invoicing and accounting. This one is more as a whole business management. That also increased, like in the survey, we got the 3x willingness to pay. And in the end, we got the 2x ARPA. So it's a very interesting play of different elements. So yes, you have how you put things on a page. You have all this data from the survey and the pricing points and what features matter, but also like playing a bit with distribution curves and positioning. And I guess that's the benefit of combining growth and marketing at the same time, because you can go from positioning to data surveys.
That's really interesting. As you say, you need like to take yourself out of the typical way to do things, to show SaaS pricing and reimagine how you need to explain that. I love what you say about positioning, because I'm a big fan of positioning. In fact, I think most of the time we start doing like growth techniques and so on, but we don't have a clear positioning. What can you tell us about how the positioning and how changing or optimizing, how you can optimize your positioning to increase the average order value, ARPA, or whatever in any SaaS business?
To be honest, I think that's the only key project we did that touches on positioning. Other than that, we did jobs to be done research earlier last year, which helped a lot on writing copy and so on nowadays. But I would still say there's more to do. And I like to take this more data-driven approach to the positioning, but it's still a matter of testing things out and understanding the landscape and understanding your customers in the end. Because I think Twitter was famous for this like almost a decade ago, like focus on the people that get it, not those that don't get it. So focus on your best customers and see what's the main value they get and why and how they see you, and try to kind of make all the others understand that. But, you know, if they go, they go. And that's especially as a product-led growth approach, like we don't insist on things. So we try to represent the product as accurately as possible and let people explore it. No sales pitch, no sales demo. We have some webinars and so on, but we encourage people to take as much as possible a self-serve approach.
That's great. Also, I would like to ask you about some other learnings you may have had in the past 2-3 years in Typhoon, in Holded, while testing growth strategies, and then you can share, because you think they can be like learnings that any or almost any SaaS business can apply.
That's a very wide one. There is a strong interlink between everything, and you need to start seeing this. And the more you think of this growth as an equation, the more you put the pieces together. So the channels you have and your positioning, of course, are related. Also, your ARPA is related to that. Also, who are you going to sell your company to in the future is related to ARPA and so on, because it has to fit your buyer's profile. So it's kind of being very specific about which way you go and what matters at different points. Like, for example, for Typhoon, we even went into brand channel fit at some point. So what kind of brand resonates with the kind of approach you take to acquisition? and pricing and so on. So it's being very clear about these elements and focus a lot on yourself as in your company rather than trying to replicate bits and pieces of advice you hear from different companies, because then you just get into this like trying different approaches. And I've talked to a few startups just asking for advice, and I could see how they just get, oh, we want to try a bit of this and a bit of that, and we have these channels, but we cannot say no to this. And this is a very slippery slope. So you need to be very clear. And something I tell people just to ease up, because I know it's not easy to say no to things, is that technically you can do everything in time. It's just not all at once. So it's not like saying no forever, but one thing at a time as much as possible.
And also, as you have a lot of experience on software as a service, I think that many people, they think that launching your product and reaching the market, it's kind of easy because they start to read people who did it and you can learn a lot from people like you. So what do you think are the most difficult things in order to grow a software as a service? If you want, for example, to not be as wide, this question as wide, just if you can say, for example, if maybe our mobile market channels or maybe inside of the funnel?
I like to look a lot at what stage you are at, and I mainly define three stages. One is before you reach product market fit, which is a whole other game. Like you need to make sure that you solve something specific for a specific type of people. And until you nail that, even forget about scaling channels. Yeah, try to get some customers in different ways, but the point is not to build any channels. Then the next stage is growth, when you have the product market fit. And here I would recommend growing one channel at a time and that get diluted. So reserve, I don't know, 20% of your efforts to try out things. If you get validation, park them for a proper planning when you want to truly scale them. But focus on scaling something. And that depends on other things, like depends on the resources you have, the competitive advantages that you have. Try to stand out and so on. And then there is a third stage, which is the inflection point, where you cannot continue doing things the way you did. So you kind of start plateauing and you need to look into another strategy. That might mean changing your target customer, changing your product, launching a new product, going into new markets, and so on. So all these three stages are very different, and how you treat customer acquisition in each of them, it's super different. So I would say only in the middle stage, in the scale one, it's where you go and like really execute and build channel after channel. In the other two, it's less about the acquisition, and it's more about this exploration of which who is the perfect customer and nailing that down.
I will also to as a part of our audience are founders and people creating a startup and business, and at some point they need to bring in someone from of growth to the team. Let's say I don't know if the best option is to start with a VP of growth, or if you need to start with a growth expert or whatsoever. But if you were a founder and you will need to create a growth team, where would you start, and what to check in those profiles to know that you are hiring the right person?
So to tie back into the three stages I said before, I would not touch this while you are still reaching product market fit. I would touch it in the stage of scaling, but not in the beginning, after you already done some things and got somewhere. And in inflection point, I think it could work, but you need more of a strategic approach rather than a growth mindset. So timing is important when to hire these people. Then I would say it's very challenging times now to hire this, because most people, I mean, it's a new role. Like most people will come with a background in something else. So try to look for as much horizontality as possible. And as I said, in my case, it worked because I specialize in a specific business model. So SaaS, later product-led growth within SaaS. So in that, I did quite a lot of cross-functional projects before I got into a growth role. So you have to set your expectations right, that you won't find a person with 5 years in growth experience at top businesses in the world. It's just like it's information now. So you need to assess much more the character and the capabilities rather than experience on paper. On marketing, it's a classic, right? You'll find lots of people with a lot of experience for many years doing all sorts of things, but in growth, it's kind of new. So you need to test, okay, are they data-driven? Do they understand different business areas? Did they prove that they can work cross-functionally really well because different people with different backgrounds work in different way? Do they understand the business metrics and the business overall quite well? Something I actually like to do, it's never just have an interview, but actually go into the company, get some data, talk to people, but really intensively, like 1 or 2 days, like just focus on this, come up with a plan, although it's very raw and might be refined after, but at least you have more or less an understanding, like get someone that shows they get the full picture. Think of areas where you don't have people at the moment. So as I said, monetization, it's an interesting starting point for this, where you don't necessarily have to put, okay, I have a growth team, cross-functional with everything inside. Like, no, start small, start with something practical, start with something you're missing. Yeah, I would say these are the main ones that come to mind right now.
Those are really interesting. And specifically, what does a VP of growth does? Because the role of VPs, I think, sometimes are misunderstood. And I've seen some companies like failing because they bring up a VP like you, something with a lot of experience and so on, maybe earlier that they need it. Which is the role and when you need a VP and not a head of growth or not just a growth manager?
It's a very good question. And I would say VPs are not a silver bullet. So if you have a big gap, like you get a VP, but then the next level, it's a senior manager, that's not going to work much. Of course, when you decide to hire the VP, you can also decide to hire something in between as well. So at Holded, we kind of like define the key mid-level roles that I had to bring in quite fast to make it work. The other thing I would mention is when you get people at head level and so on, you can focus on some optimizations and tweaks and like things that people have experience in doing them. A VP is more able to connect the dots of the business. So it's simply just much more experience. A VP would also be able to handle the investors directly, which is quite important. So it depends at which level you are as a founder and at which level of fundraising you are. But that's quite useful as well in terms of how do you explain things to VCs, how you present information, how you handle questions, and so on. And a good VP profile helps you hire some more people as well.
That's a really good one to be able to bring more talent to the team. You also say that you were a founder, you founded your own company, and at some time you started to have leadership roles in other companies such as Holded. How was your transition in a more personal way? Because I think it's hard to. You have a leadership position when you are a founder, but it's different than when you have the founders in the company. How did you feel and what's your learnings doing that transition?
Which transition exactly are you referring to?
From being a founder, as you said, you founded your companies and so on. And after some years, to be in a leadership position, VP, but in a company you have not founded?
I had my own businesses when I was like at the beginning of my career. So I would say I was a bit more rough around the edges back then, also much more bold and like trying stuff, but I missed a bit the experience. Which is good because in a sense it propelled all my career after because I tried more things than if I would have taken a normal career path where you grow slowly and your responsibilities grow with time. Like I went directly, like boom. So it helps because you understand different sides of the business. You understand what it means to be a founder. You can empathize with the founders. So it's really, really helpful down the line. And the entrepreneurial spirit can come in all sorts of shapes and forms. It doesn't necessarily mean that someone had their own business before, but, you know, you can just see, you know, some side projects or something where they take initiative and they do something on their own. This would be, I would always recommend an entrepreneur mindset. I'm always finding value in this. And also an important question for me in interviews, which is kind of related to the entrepreneurial mindset, is like, what's the last thing you learned and how did you learn it? Because I'm sorry, we live in a world where if you don't constantly shape up your skills and what you learn, either practically, theoretically, whatever, and super fast and finding ways, that's not going to work. And it's kind of related to this entrepreneurial spirit, like just roll up your sleeves and get going. So that helps. It's also sometimes I find myself like, you know, caring a lot about the business and having a lot of thoughts in my mind around how I would do things because you get charged, but you're ultimately not a founder. So this is where the growth mindset does help, because with time you learn more and more to be more analytical about things and to understand the different perspectives rather than just go with opinions. And yeah, I would really recommend everyone to try to have something, not necessarily like a full business under their belt, but kind of like some initiative that they run, even a personal project or something. It does teach you a lot of things. So I think it's an interesting thing to have.
I totally agree. I would also want you to ask you a question that regards Juanma is our head of growth, and today and these days we were talking to him because he is like overwhelmed with a lot of work and he's starting to know how to delegate. I think in every role in your career you've been learning how to delegate at different levels. What's your learning there? What do you have to delegate? What do you have to keep yourself? And I think it's hard, but I'm pretty sure a lot of companies are growing their growth departments and can learn from your experience learning to delegate and growing the team.
Yes, that's a very important one, I would say. I like a lot to define owners for every hour project and so on. Sometimes it's just a simple thing, so it's one name. Sometimes I use a DAISY framework, which I really recommend for more complex things. So it's driver, approver, contributors, informed. You can find all sorts of articles online about this. It's very powerful. And with this, I like to empower people to, you know, take their own decisions over. So what do you think is the right thing to do and so on. And I like to see reasoning. So I would always ask, you know, why. But I would respect people's decision if they're like strong on their point. So I never make it like I would be the ultimate approver. But obviously, I have my own responsibilities at the end, which is quite a few important business metrics. And ultimately, I just need to see, okay, I empower people as much as possible. I need to make sure we also hire the right people. And it's always hard. So at some point, it's like, what if something is not working, where is the issue and what do you need to change? Is it a talent issue? Is it an execution issue? Like we need to restructure ourselves or do things differently? Is it a resources issue? Is it a strategy issue? So this is more where I would intervene. And of course, it's not easy to let go. And sometimes you don't control all the details and it's hard. And as I said, you ultimately take the responsibility. But if you are constantly the approver or the idea maker or anything, in the end, you're just a team of one rather than a team of many. So you can go somewhere, but you can go way too far.
That's a good one. Juanma, we need everyone in the team need to learn about this. It's hard.
Yeah, it's hard, but necessary. So for sure, I'm going to apply this.
Hey, Adelina, just to finish, because we've been an hour with you, we can be like a lot of hours because you say a lot of interesting things, but we need to leave you and get some rest. I really like what you said just a minute before, and I'm going to make you that question. What was the last thing you learned?
Probably because we talked a lot about it, and it's not necessarily the last.
Yeah.
The last things were actually a lot of things on my individual performance and health related. So I perform better at work, but I'll leave this aside. So because we talked a lot about this, I would say monetization. So which was last year. But I think it's an interesting way of portraying how I went around it. So in previous companies, I was in marketing roles. We had pricing changes roughly once a year. So I was part of it as a contributor. I've seen the different impacts of different things, how it works. I used to read a lot of psychology books and so on, just general psychology, customer psychology. But then last year when we decided to do this, I was like, okay, it's within my area. It's one of the growth levers. I look at the whole growth equation and I really think we can have a higher ARPA without going up market based on different things. But it's still, I declared it a wild card. So it's not necessarily guaranteed that it's going to work, but it's worth addressing because the impact would be quite high. The next thing I did was enroll in this Reforge course. I learned how to do everything myself. I knew about, for example, about Price Intelligently and their framework, and they were like trainers in this course. So I just absorbed everything. Then I was like, okay, let's do a survey. Let's get the data, outsource for some panels to get unbiased data and so on. And from there was just regular leadership on, all right, how do we involve different people in different areas and we get this done? And of course, there were lots of opinions on lots of proposals, even if it was based on data, and how do you navigate all that and so on. And in the end, it was a success. So it was an interesting thing to learn that I got myself into knowingly. I want to learn this and I want to do it and I want to see how it is when you proactively lead it and learn it on purpose. So I would mention this one because we talked a lot about this and what was the, but yeah, the last things I'm learning are literally how to be more performant based on biohacks. And I have a mini lab next to my coffee and tea maker with all sorts of powders and things that I'm adding and exploring.
Oh, that sounds really good and crazy. What's about that? Is it like mixing nutrients or?
Yeah, so I learned that, you know, coffee gives you the high but also the lows and the jitters, so like how do you balance that to have only the good effects but not the bad effects, and just generally things that lower your inflammation or feed your microbiome because that has an impact on how you feel, and avoiding foods that you're sensitive to, and yeah, just balancing things for your heart rate and everything. So I got to increase my energy and focus level and mental clarity quite a lot.
Oh, that's great. It's hacking yourself.
It is.
This is also growth.
Yeah. Adelina, thanks a lot for this hour, more than hour, because I've extracted a lot of learnings. I'm pretty sure Juanma and Pavel also. Right, guys?
Thanks a lot for the questions. It was a very interesting chat.
We are pretty sure the audience is right now like crazy and taking a lot of notes. So they there are a lot of things to apply. Adelina, thanks a lot for your time. So we are really happy to have you here. And thank you.
Thank you. Have a nice evening.
Bye to everyone.
Hey.
Bye-bye.
Si te has quedado con ganas de más growth, vete a go.producthackers.com, nuestra comunidad y formación sobre growth que te ayudará a llevar a tu empresa al siguiente nivel.